Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for coming. Before I introduce our speaker, I'd like to say a few thank yous. This event would not have been possible without generous help from the Undercurrent, the Associated Students of Stanford University, and the Federalist Society. Dr. Gatte is a senior fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute. He teaches at the Institute's Objectivist Academic Center, speaks on philosophy and objectivism across North America, and publishes scholarly and popular articles on Ayn Rand's philosophy and fiction. His op-eds have appeared on CNN, FoxNews.com, BusinessWeek.com, and he has given numerous radio addresses, including on NPR and BBC Radio. He has appeared as a television guest on CNBC, KCET, and the CBS Evening News. Dr. Gatte received his doctorate in philosophy from the University of Calgary, and tonight he'll be speaking about how selfishness might serve as an inspiring source of moral guidance. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a sincere pleasure to introduce Dr. Ankar Gatte.
Thank you. Thanks, Adam, for the introduction, and thank you for the clubs for inviting me. It's a privilege to be here. Thanks for coming out on a Thursday night. So my talk is entitled, as I hope you know, Rethinking Selfishness. And I'm exploring Ayn Rand's conception of egoism or conception of selfishness. And what I'm aiming to do is to give an overview of her approach to this topic, and then in the Q&A we can delve into more specific or some deeper issues if somebody cares to ask a question. And I want to start with a certain question that I get often, I think Ayn Rand got often, and it's the question, why use the term selfishness? Why use it as a positive term? One of the most common views in morality that you would see everywhere, you will see it shared by Democrats, Republicans, secular people, religious people, is that selfishness is bad. Selfishness is wrong. Selfishness is evil. There's almost 100% agreement on that idea. So if you tell someone, as Ayn Rand tells people, well, I'm for selfishness, I'm pro-selfishness, this is the reaction you get. And so is it that she's using the term basically to provoke? To just say, well, I've got a different view. Yeah, it's not going to turn out that I'm actually for selfishness, though I don't think it's as bad as people think it is. But I'm going to use the term as a kind of PR stunt. And I think that's definitely not how she thinks about this issue. She has a whole book entitled The Virtue of Selfishness. And the title's not a PR stunt. It's not, I don't really mean this, but this will sell books, so I'm going to title my book The Virtue of Selfishness. She literally means that selfishness is a virtue. So she's really challenging at a very deep level our understanding of this whole issue and our views on this whole issue. And her point is that we're completely wrong in thinking about the issue of selfishness, that we think it's basically obvious that selfishness is evil. She thinks it's far from obvious, and it's not even true. But to understand why, you have to then explore how she approaches this whole issue and why she thinks our kind of conventional understanding of selfishness is wrong. So she really views herself as a moral crusader, who's trying to overturn views that are widely held and almost unquestionably thought, well, yeah, everybody knows selfishness is evil. What's the next thing to talk about? And there have been, so you're in a strange position when you're challenging received moral views. Because when you're challenging them, it's, well, but your position's immoral. We all know, anyone who's championed selfishness, well, we all know it's evil. So there has to be something wrong with your whole view. And the real moral crusaders don't back down from that kind of fight. And I think this is true of Ayn Rand. So if you think of other kind of big sea changes in our thoughts about morality, then think just about America. Take two big episodes where there was a real moral struggle and there was a minority advocating for a certain view that the majority knew was, well, that's wrong and that's a crazy view. Take the abolitionist movement of the 19th century or women's suffrage in the 19th and 20th centuries. These started off as views that were completely outside the mainstream. Slavery was a received institution. It sort of makes it into the Constitution. It's a compromise. But it is, this is, then you need some form of slavery. That was a dominant view in the and particularly in the early 19th century. And it would be taken as, there were certain justifications for that institution, including such a thing as, well, everybody knows that a black person is inferior, he's an unintelligent person. Everybody knows that. He can't be fully self-governing, he's not capable of that. We're doing him a favor by making him a servant or even a slave. There's that kind of argument. And it is a type of received wisdom. And there's people who challenge this and say that our whole understanding of this is completely wrong and has to be addressed at that level, that there's something deeply wrong in your whole thinking about race and race relations and that it makes a difference. Or in regard to women, I mean, it was received opinion that a woman is basically, I put it as a bimbo. How could a woman weigh in on the difficult issues of politics? How could we give her the vote? And the vote comes in early 20th century. I mean, it's not even 100 years since women have the vote. And this was received wisdom. And if you told someone, well, look, when you're talking about this, well, don't talk about women, because we all know that they can't think. Use a different term. No, they're challenging. You're completely wrong in your thought that a woman's place is in the home, barefoot and pregnant. That is a completely wrong view. And it has to be challenged at that level, that how you think about this is completely wrong. And Ayn Rand's view in regard to selfishness is, yes, it's a received opinion that a selfish person is evil. Everybody knows that. And yet, what everybody knows, she thinks, is completely wrong. And so she's challenging, and she's deliberate. So when she uses the term, there is a sort of provocation to it. But she thinks that our thinking about this whole issue is deeply flawed, deeply mistaken. And that if you learn to think about this and to properly and clearly think about this issue, you'll have a very different view of selfishness. And of selfishness and of what that term really means if you understand it properly. And this is what, I've put the lecture as rethinking selfishness, but another way you could put it, it's about reclaiming selfishness. Reclaiming the notion and properly understanding it and with a proper understanding of seeing why it is actually something good. So, and when you're challenging received wisdom, so I put it, she's challenging us to radically question our beliefs. And she thinks we're in a sort of predicament in regard to the issue of selfishness. That I'll put it this way. It's a saying that's attributed to Mark Twain that I think it's a helpful thing to think about in life, and particularly in regard to philosophical issues. And it's the saying, it's ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. And it is, everyone knew for sure that blacks are inferior and can't be self-governing and self-directing. Everyone knew that, well, the women, you can't give them a vote. That would be a disaster for our government. And everyone knows that selfishness is evil. And I'm putting these all in the categories of things that you know for sure that just ain't so. Now, to get at the whole issue of selfishness, I mean, from what I've said so far, a pushback would be, no, we know what selfishness means. And when you understand what it means, you know full well that it's evil. So if you think, what does selfishness mean? To be selfish, it means to be concerned with the self, to be concerned with advancing the interests of yourself. And we know that to be evil. So we all know that selfishness or self-interest, we know what it consists in, and when you think of what it consists in, you know that it's evil. Take some common examples of people who would be called selfish. That's a mugshot of Al Capone in Alcatraz. This is a person who dominates others, lives through theft and robbery, is a murderer. He's out for himself, it will be said. He's selfish. This is so. When thinking about the issue of selfishness, this is one common type of example, an Al Capone type of figure brought up. Well, we know he's selfish. Another type. This is the kind of driver, cuts everyone off, couldn't care about anyone else. He's in it for himself, it will be said. Total callous disregard for other people. I have him giving the finger here. This person's selfish. Concerned with the self, concerned with his self-interest. He's not a very savory character. He might be better than an Al Capone, but he's still not very savory. A third type of person. I tried to get the sleaziest used car salesman I could get a photo of. This is a person who has no principles, no convictions. He'll say anything to make the sale, tell different people different stories. He's a con artist and lives that way. He's out for himself. So he's selfish. So this is what selfishness consists in. It's some kind of life like this. Well, these aren't very savory. We know these to be evil. So selfishness is evil. What's there to think about? But now, just pause. There's more to say about our understanding of selfishness, but just pause here. Selfishness means, if you look in the dictionary, it means concerned chiefly with yourself, with your interests. It means to be dedicated or devoted to the interest of yourself. Now, just at this level, imagine you had a son or a daughter. You do all kinds of things for them, for their interest, to advance their interest. You could put it to advance the interest of themselves. You teach them to walk. You teach them to read. You teach them to count and learn math. You teach them a whole variety of things. And now as they're getting older and setting out on a life and on a more independent life now, they don't need you anymore, would your advice be, well, if you want to continue advancing your interests, become an Al Capone, or become this guy, or become a sleazy used car salesman. If you're truly interested in advancing your own interests, yourself, that's what you would do. And that's the advice you would recommend to them. Or put it a little differently, in a more personal kinds of way. If what you're trying to do with your son or daughter is put them on a quest to achieve happiness in their lives, which is another angle at which to look at the issue of advancing their own interests, that they're achieving happiness in their lives, is this what you would recommend that they become? Is this what you would try to guide them towards? I suggest that that should at least raise a question of, no, that's not what I would tell them to do. Because it's not in their interest to do. And yet this is our conception of what selfishness is, which means to be advancing your interest. So there's something wrong in this. But it's even worse than that. Because these are not the only people who will be labeled and denounced as selfish. Take another figure. Bill Gates, as a creator, a co-founder of Microsoft, a creator of what became the largest software company, by many counts the richest man in the world, he's out for himself. He made oodles and oodles of money. He's seeking profits. He's out for himself. He's selfish. And therefore, there's something wrong and something evil in what he does. So you've got an idea or a notion or a concept that puts together a Bill Gates and an Al Capone. And they're both selfish, and we know selfishness is evil, so there's both something there's evil in them or about them. Now, I submit to you that there's nothing to learn about Bill Gates by studying Al Capone. And there's nothing to learn when you study Bill Gates about Al Capone. These are way different people, way different kinds of lives. This person steals and robs. This person created a fortune. In the process, enriching his employees and all the customers and clients that he dealt with, he's one of the central figures in the whole personal computer revolution, which has revolutionized our lives. It's for the young people here, I mean, I can still remember a time pre-computers. You have no idea how different life was. The idea of using GPS and email and being connected 24/7, I mean, just that's not what life was like. And he's one of the figures responsible for bringing that kind of life into existence. And we're going to label him as we label an Al Capone: selfish, evil, something wrong with what he's doing. Or take as a counter to this this nasty kind of character: a child playing by himself. Maybe he's got some new toys. He wants to explore them. This looks like a train set. Well, he should share. It's selfish to be focused on himself. And maybe it's the kids around him have been mean to him, and now he doesn't want to share his new toy with them. Well, that's selfish. You're focused only on yourself. There's something wrong with that. Now, again, I submit there's nothing to learn by studying this guy, and then you'll find out something about this child, that there's something in common between these two, even though we label both selfish. I've put a last figure. In the debates in the shutdown, of the government shutdown, one of the criticisms of the Republicans — now, I'm not a fan of the Republicans, nor of how they approach this whole issue — but one of the criticisms of the Republicans were they're holding the country hostage, hostage to their ideology, to their extreme ideas. They should compromise. They should give in and give up their ideas. It's selfish to be concerned with what they think is right, with their principles, with their ideology. Now, I've put up a figure involved in politics who is much more extreme than Republicans. This is William Lloyd Garrison, one of the central figures in the abolition movement. He would have been denounced as his position is extreme, which is that slavery is completely immoral. It's against the Declaration and should be a Declaration of Independence and should be abolished. He held fast to that position in all kinds of arguments over years and years. And he was told to compromise, and it was, no, I'm not going to compromise because slavery is an evil institution. He held fast to his extreme position. That's selfish. So there's something wrong with that. That is evil. So you put into the same category a sleazy used car salesman and a principled political leader. It's both selfish. They're concerned with the self. We know that's evil. So that all these people are doing something wrong. Now, when you have an idea like this or a notion, selfishness, that puts together this disparate collection of people and tells you they're all the same and you should have the same views about them, and we know selfishness is evil, so you should think of all these people, well, there's something evil about them. There's something really wrong with that idea or that notion. If that's what it's forcing you to do, it's forcing you to regard all these people as the same and to put them all in the category of they're bad, and they're doing something wrong. Now, it's much more plausible. I mean, you would have to know the details of the person's life, but it's much more plausible to think of these people as they're actually concerned with themselves and advancing their interests than it is to think of these people. And yet what happens is, well, We call these people selfish. We know what they do is exploit and victimize other people. So everyone who's selfish must do that, because that's why we're putting them into the same category. So you get the idea of a Bill Gates who created a fortune, who enriched the lives of countless people. You get the idea, well, he's selfish, so he must be an exploiter. He must make victims of other people. And you get the whole phenomenon, which is what happened to Bill Gates, of being dragged in front of the Justice Department, basically for the crime of being too good, that he was better than his competitors, the crime of giving away Internet Explorer for free. I mean, imagine that, of making victims of everybody by giving this away for free. But he's selfish. He's after his own interest. We know that that's bad. We know that that means exploitation and victimization. So he must have done that. And we'll have a detailed investigation and go through his emails for months and months and months to find some hint of some idea that he's made a victim of somebody. And that's a tremendous injustice. I mean, one should feel real gratitude for what Bill Gates, as one of the leaders of the computer revolution, the personal computer revolution, of what he did. It's a tremendous injustice to put him before the so-called Justice Department and say, you've done something wrong, and we're going to make you atone for it. But it is, if you put him into the category of he's selfish, and you put these other people in the category of selfish, then there must be something the same about them. And there must be some smoking gun to find. And that is what we're going to go out and pursue. So there's something deeply wrong with this idea Ayn Rand holds. And it leads to tremendous injustice. Because it leads to viewing good people as evil. Now it leads to a further kind of real interference or distortion of our thinking about the whole issue of what it means to be concerned with one's interest. Because, to go back to, if you're fishing for something that unites these, something that you could put them, yeah, there is something the same about them. Typically what you get is the idea. To be selfish means to do whatever you want to do, whatever you feel like doing. If what you want to do is create a huge software company, okay, that's what you want to do, that's selfish. If what you want to do is rob and steal and murder people, well, that's what you want to do, that's selfish. If you want to move the country in the direction of freedom and fight against slavery, well, that's what you want to do, that's selfish. If you want to con people out of their money by selling them lemons, well, that's what you want to do. So that's selfish. Selfishness means just doing whatever you want to do. And on that level, everyone, well, at least some of the time, does what they want to do. So everybody's selfish. Which means that everybody has at least a tinge of evil within them. So the next conclusion is, well, therefore everybody has a touch or tinge of evil in them. And what you need morality for, then, is to slice away at this evil. So the whole conception of morality becomes morality is needed to suppress evil. Well, and what is evil? Selfishness. And what is selfishness? To do what you want. So what is morality about? About telling you not to do what you want. One of the ways Ayn Rand puts it, what morality becomes is a knife that slashes away at your desires. And it treats as equal whether what you desire to do is murder somebody or build Microsoft. You want to do it? That's selfish? That's evil? Don't do it. And let me bring in Bill Gates again, because I think this is actually part of what happened to him. Now, I don't know him. So this is in part speculation, but I've looked at what he said about his shift in focus and his retirement from Microsoft and what he's doing now in his philanthropy. And I think there's definitely an element of what I want to do is stop being evil. I want to do something good. Was he passionate about creating Microsoft? Yes. When you hear him talk, you can even get that there's still that passion that he's put on the back burner, that it's not a passion he's going to kindle when he talks about the company. Because what he's supposed to do, if he's to be good, is to not do what he wants to do. And what he passionately wants to do is create and run Microsoft. What morality is about is telling you, no, don't do what you want to do. That would be selfish. So it is what he's doing in part, I don't think in whole, but in part, is to combat the selfishness within it. And that too, I mean, apart from a tremendous injustice towards Bill Gates, is a tremendous loss for us. I mean, what he could be doing in the computer industry and what he could be doing for Microsoft and to have a competitor for Apple and Google, he could be doing a tremendous amount. But he's been deflected from that because, well, it would be selfish. And it was selfish to be pursuing what he wanted to pursue, and he should be doing something different. Now, Ayn Rand's view is that this is totally wrong from start to finish. And then let me go sort of in reverse order. The conception of morality, what morality is about is slashing away what you want to do. That is a completely false view of what morality is about. So one way she puts it, this is from Atlas Shrugged, is that the purpose of morality is to teach you not to suffer and die, but to enjoy yourself and live. It's the purpose of morality is not to slash away at what you want, but to help teach you what you should want, what you should be striving for, and how to attain it. So it's to think about the goals to pursue, to think about what you want, and why you want it, and why you should want it. And when you're convinced of that, to have how to pursue it. It's about achieving something. It's about achieving your life and about achieving real values. But one has to think about it. And that there's a difference between, and there's a radical difference between what an Al Capone wants and what a Bill Gates wants. That they don't belong in the same category. One lies on the side of good and values and should be pursued, and the other doesn't. And that morality is to help you. It's not an obstacle put in your path. It's not a hindrance. It's not something to slash away at your desires. And that the counterpart of that is that few people are actually selfish. So there's this view that everybody's selfish. Ayn Rand's view is, no, that is not true at all. To be selfish is to be concerned with advancing your own interests, which means you have a conception of what your interests are and how to advance them. And that is a difficult perspective to gain on life. And without that, you can't speak of someone who's actually pursuing their self-interest. But if somebody actually does that, it's an achievement and it's something good. So selfishness, or to put it in more emotional terms, the pursuit of one's own happiness is something good. And she has this different perspective because she rejects this root idea. She rejects the idea that selfishness means doing whatever you want. This is a common view today, and she thinks it's completely wrong. That what selfishness means is you're devoted to advancing your interests. And that to do that is the opposite of doing whatever you want, whatever strikes you. And to give an illustration of this or a way to think about it, take just one aspect of what it means to advance your interests. Take just the aspect of thinking about your physical interest or your physical health as one aspect of what it would mean to advance the total of your interest, to be concerned with this. Now, would you say of someone that while he's concerned with advancing his physical interest, his health, if he does whatever he wants to do? So to be healthy is just to do whatever you want to do. You want to eat these cupcakes. You want to eat 3 cupcakes for breakfast every day and wash it down with 2 beers. And you're going to do that day in, day out. And that's what you want to do. So I guess that means that that's in your physical interest to do. Because you want to do it. So that's advancing your interests. Now, nobody would buy that. that to advance your interest, to advance your health, is just to do whatever, and the mere fact that you want to do it makes it in your interest to do. The mere fact that you want to eat 3 cupcakes a day makes it in your interest to do. Now, if you don't accept that in regard to one's physical interest or your physical health, you shouldn't accept it when you think of the total. Indeed, it's a much more complex issue when you're thinking of the total of a person's interest, not just their physical, though that's a subset of a person's interest, but the total of their interest. Of, as Ayn Rand will often put it, of mind and body, or of soul and body. If you think of the interest of the whole person, what it means to advance them is not just do whatever you want to do. It's the opposite of just doing whatever the hell strikes you. It is to advance one's physical health requires a conception of, well, what is physical health? What are its conditions? What are its requirements? What actually produces physical health? And then to enact that in your actual life, to put yourself on a course, on a healthy course of life. And the same, she thinks, is true in regard to your interests as a whole, talking not just in physical terms, but mind and body. You need a real conception of what is in your interests, and then to go out and set and dedicate your life to advancing your interests. And that is something difficult to do. And it's an achievement to do this. So it takes work to create a self. And this is in the rest of the talk, I want to focus on this idea. That self, when we're talking about the interest of the self, mind and body, but I'm going to stress particularly the mind aspect or the soul aspect. To talk about the interest of the self presupposes that there is a self who has interest. And the very creation of a self, and this is how Ayn Rand talks about it, a self is created. You're not born with a self. You're born with a physical body. But to have an actual self or to have an actual soul such that you can talk about now you're advancing your interests or you're on the quest and pursuit of happiness, that is a real achievement on her view. And it basically comes from two things. So that a self is created. You're not born with a self. And it's created in two, there's kind of two dimensions to it if you look at the basics of our whole view. And it's crucial to, if selfishness means a devotion to the self, you need an understanding of the self before you can have a notion of selfishness. And this is part of what is wrong with the conventional understanding. There's no understanding of what it means to have a self. And yet we think we know what it means to be selfish, which means to be advancing the interest of the self. It puts, in effect, the cart before the horse. And what you need is a conception of the self, and that it has two components, that you have real convictions, real principles, so ideas that you hold fast to because you have reasons for thinking they're true. You have convictions or principles that will form the framework of your life. And you have reasons for thinking that those principles, that framework, is correct. It's not accepted because, well, everyone else thinks it's right, or it's not accepted on faith. It's accepted because you have reasons for thinking that what I hold fast to is true. So you have real convictions and you have real values. And here it means that you're pursuing goals that you have reason to think are life-advancing or life-affirming. So think again, take Bill Gates, his conception of what he regards as valuable. He has a whole mission, in effect, in the creation and building of Microsoft. It's part of the personal computer revolution. He has this idea of a computer on every desk. And he has a conception of why that's valuable, of what that could do for people, how that could revolutionize the world. He has a view, a thought-out view of why it's something valuable, of why it's something life-affirming. And then he dedicates himself, until he gives it up, but he dedicates himself to the creation and to the pursuit of that. That is what a real value looks like. It's not borrowed from other people. It's not secondhand. It's a real value that he has reason for thinking is something good or valuable to pursue. And both of these then take a lot of thought and a lot of work to have real convictions and real values. And Ayn Rand's view is that not everyone does this, that many people don't have a self. And so you can't even talk about the issue of them being selfish because they don't have a self. So it's very, very different from the view that everybody's selfish. And if you want one thing to read of Ayn Rand's on this issue, it's one of her works of fiction, The Fountainhead, which is focused on the issue of what it means to have a self. And it's a book that resonates particularly with people in high school, college, just out of college. Because it's at that age that if you're going to form a self, it's at that age that you are on the quest and on the path to form a self. And this gives you both, The Fountainhead gives both inspiration for that quest and for that journey and a lot of guidance and a lot of advice, I think, about what it means to create a self. And let me just talk a little bit about the kind of dual perspective. There's much more in The Fountainhead than this, but the perspective on what it means to have a self or not have a self. Take first the negative, a lack of self. One of the ways in which a person never forms a self, from Ayn Rand's perspective, is that they're way too focused on other people. That other people, in effect, dictate the course of their thinking and the course of their lives. There's nothing self-generated or self-directed, nothing coming from the person. And you get all kinds of variants of this in The Fountainhead. One of the central characters, not the hero of the novel, the hero of the novel is Howard Roark. One of the central characters, Peter Keating, is a thoroughly conventional person who does what's expected of him. When whatever social situation and social circle he's in, he does what's expected of him. He goes into architecture. The book centers around the profession of architecture. He goes into architecture because his mother and some of his professors are pushing him into the field. It's a nice, respectable field that a respectable young man would go into. Now, Peter Keating happens to be interested in painting and not really interested in architecture. But that's what he goes into because it's what's expected and it's what's respectable to go into. And in everything, he's like that. The woman he ends up marrying, well, he marries her when he's at the height of the architectural profession. And it's, again, the kinds of considerations are, what kind of woman would people expect me to be with if I'm at the height and if I'm to stay at the top? Not who am I in love with, but what would be expected of me in this situation? And that is what moves him towards the woman he ends up marrying. And it's everything that you see about him. It's thoroughly conventional. It's thoroughly with a gaze to what other people are doing. So for him, there's no real convictions of his. His ideas happen to be whatever other people's ideas happen to be. And that's what he imitates and that's what he emulates. And the things he pursues in life, from a career to his wife, are the things that other people think he should pursue. They can't be real values to him. They're not thought through. He doesn't have a view about, well, would this be good or not? Is this life advancing or not? It's what other people say I should be doing. There's no self there. That's one variant you get in The Fountainhead. Another is money and fame chasers. People will do anything to get a buck or anything to get their name in the headlines. It's, again, what they're doing, it doesn't flow from any real convictions on their part. Or any view of what I'm doing is correct, what I'm doing is valuable to do, is the, so take the common, one of the common kinds of examples of these people, not in The Fountainhead, box office chasers. I'll write whatever script or movie that I think other people would happen to like. Do I think it's any good? No, I don't think about that kind of issue. There's no conviction, no personal conviction or personal values there. There's no self. Is part of the message of The Fountainhead. Another variant is power seekers. people out to control, to manipulate, to dominate others. Their whole focus becomes on, what do I need to say to deceive or manipulate or control other people? What do I need to do? It doesn't come from any inner spring or inner well. There's, again, no real convictions or values on the person. It's a total focus on other people. And they fill a sort of vacuum in the person. A fourth kind of example that you get in the Fountainhead, I've termed it counterculture rebels. It's basically the flip side of a Peter Keating. Peter Keating, in whatever social situation he's in, does what's expected of him. He looks what the conventions are and what the norms are, and that's what I'll do. And you get a kind of person who does something similar to that, looks at the conventions and norms, and says, I'm going to do the opposite. But it's as much a focus on other people and what they think, as little a focus on what do I think is true and what do I think is right. There's no such concern. I'm just going to do the opposite of what Peter Keating does, the same thing as other people. They just do the opposite of other people. And all these kinds of variants, what you get in the Fountainhead, is none of them have real convictions or values. So none of them have a self. And part of what the novel explores, and this is something Ayn Rand had a view, which I think is definitely right, that to think about moral issues, it's indispensable to think about them in terms of stories and of literature, and particularly literature, because literature allows you to delve into the psychology of people. You see the outer action and the inner workings, and to think about the whole issue of morality, you need to think about both of those. But what you see, I mean, Fountainhead is a 700-page book. What you see, and you see reasons for why, for all these kinds of people, there's a real emptiness inside, a void or a vacuum. And what that amounts to is there is no self. And as a result, you can't speak of what are in their interests. The whole issue of selfishness doesn't even apply to them. So it's a far cry from the idea that everybody is selfish. And on the positive side of what you get in the Fountainhead, and of the hero of the Fountainhead, whose name is Howard Roark, is a focus not on other people, and not on trying to emulate or imitate them, nor to defy them. Though he is often in conflict and has very different views from what other people have, he doesn't hold those views because they're different and in opposition to other people. What you see and what you get a conception of is that he has real convictions. Yes, for instance, he has real convictions in the whole field of architecture. One of the scenes in the first chapter is Roark, who's a college student. He's going to be expelled unless he agrees to certain terms. And then he's invited to have a conversation with the dean. And in that conversation, Roark tells him, well, I actually don't want to stay. I've learned as much as I can, and it's time for me to move into the profession. But what you get in that scene is a difference. They have very different views about architecture. The dean thinks what architecture is about is preserving the styles of the past, of copying what has been done before in with new materials and new, whether it's steel or plastics, but the same design as that has always been done. And Roark asks him a simple question. Why? Why is that what architecture is about? Why is that what you should do? So those are the dean's convictions, but he asks him why. Why are those your convictions? And the dean's like, huh? That's what everybody says architecture is. That's not a conviction. And what he gets in an answer to Roark is, well, this is what I think about architecture. And architecture is about building buildings that serve their function and fulfill their function. And as you get new materials and new types of buildings, whether it's building an aircraft hangar, we're not going to build that like the Parthenon. And it would be stupid to do. And he has a whole, and so they have a conversation, but what you get is Roark has convictions. And what it looks, you get a conception of what it looks like to have thought out convictions. Now that's about architecture, but what you see in the book is he has these kinds of convictions about everything in life. He has views about what is true and false And he can explain why these are his convictions. He can explain why this is the framework by which he lives. And when he asks other people about, and so the dean has a certain framework for how he lives and how he thinks about architecture. But when he asks him, like, why is that your framework? It's, I don't know, I haven't asked that question. It's what everybody thinks. And that is not real convictions. And you get the same on the issue of values. What you get with Rourke is you get a real picture of what it looks like to think first-handedly, to think on one's own about what truly is good and what truly is evil, as against, say, just taking over views from the culture, which I think is what a lot of us do in regard to selfishness. Selfishness is evil? Well, why? Well, that's what everybody says. Everybody knows selfishness is evil. That is not a real thought-through value perspective. To think it through would be to think, well, what does selfishness mean? Why do we have this term? Why think it's evil? Both of these are required to have a self on Ayn Rand's view. So these are the two components, have real convictions and real values. And what it comes down to then, what the kind of picture you get, and this is why her picture of what it means to be selfish is so different from the conventional perspective. What you get is it to be selfish is to have a self. And to have a self is to have a focus on the values that you think and that you have reason to think are actually life-affirming, and then to put yourself on a path, on a quest to achieve those values. As, say, Bill Gates was on a quest to create Microsoft, and he had a real conception of why this company provided real value. It's to have that kind of focus. It's to have it in regard to one's productive work, but it's to have it in regard to everything about one's life, whether one's talking about friendships, whether one's talking about one's romantic interests, to be on a have a real view of the values you're pursuing, of why you're pursuing them, and then to dedicate your life to the pursuit of them and to let nothing sway you or deter you from that pursuit. It requires that, and that's a more outward focus on the values in the world that you want to achieve. And it requires also, these are different ways of looking at the issue of convictions and values, it requires a focus on being a person you admire. A person you admire. And of becoming and of making yourself into a person you admire. A person who has self-confidence and self-respect. And that's an achievement. And it requires thinking about what you admire and trying to build that into your own self or into your own soul. And that's what it means to have a self or to have a soul. There's a famous line in The Fountainhead where Rourke is asked, have you always liked being Howard Rourke? And his answer is a smile. And what you get, I mean, this is two-thirds of the way through the story, but what you get when you read that in context is the smile means, like, how could your answer be no? How could the answer be, have you always liked being you? How could the answer be no to that? And if the answer is no, then you better do something about it. But that's what it looks like from her perspective to have a self. And that what you get in The Fountainhead, there's, and in the person asking him, is one of the people who can't answer yes to this question. But that's a person who's not on a quest to have a self, and so that you can't speak of his self-interest. So you get a radically different perspective in Ayn Rand of the whole issue of selfishness. And it centers around what it means to have a self. And that part of her criticism, then, of the conventional notion of an Al, and think of the initial figures I put up, an Al Capone, a nasty kind of person who cuts off everybody, has no concern with anyone, no connections with any kind of people, a sleazy used car salesman. What's missing from all those people is they have no self. They have no real convictions. They have no real values. You can't speak of what is in their self-interest because they don't have a self. And what's radically different between that and, say, a Bill Gates or a William Lloyd Garrison is that they have real convictions, that they have real values, or to put it in different terms, they have a soul, or they have a self that you can then talk about. Is what they're doing advancing their self, and so the interest of the self, or are they undermining their interest in some way? And that's her conception of selfishness, but that's her conception, and she thinks it's the right conception, because what selfishness literally means, if you look in a dictionary, is to be concerned chiefly with oneself. Then you need an understanding of what is a self, and what would it mean to be concerned chiefly and put this as the paramount of my attention? And until you have that, you can't speak that, well, I have a notion or an understanding of what selfishness means. But when you do get a notion of what a self is and what it means to advance the interest of the self, then you should see it as something tremendously positive and tremendously good. If you realize it's an achievement to have a self. And then what the pursuit of self-interest really means is to preserve yourself once you've created it, to keep yourself intact and healthy. That's what morality is about. Or at least that's what morality should be about, and that's what Ayn Rand's morality is about. So her view is that selfishness is good, but a rare achievement. So it's almost the flip side of that everybody's selfish and selfishness is evil and we have to fight against that. Her view is, no, not everybody is selfish. Few people have a self. Only the people who do have a self can be selfish. And they have to dedicate themselves then 100% to that quest. So another way of looking at it, to put it a little more, her whole view of self-interest, is I brought up the issue of a parent. And or think of yourself as if you had a son or daughter. And your whole focus as a parent, if you're a good parent, is to try to do the things that advance your son or daughter's life. Try to help them to become a person, which means to have a self, and to look out for themselves, which means to advance their interests. And the whole focus of a parent is exactly that. And particularly when they're young, they do everything they can when you're young to teach you how to walk, to teach you how to read, to teach you how to speak, all the kinds of things that you're going to need to succeed and be successful in the world. It's a perspective that, from the child's perspective, is radically selfish. And we would think of a parent who doesn't do that, who said, no, I mean, that's selfish that a child is going to learn to talk or learn to walk. That's directed only at himself. That's not what you should be doing. There's something evil. You're inculcating evil in the person. We would think of a parent like that as that is monstrous kind of view. And what selfishness amounts to is taking over the job of the parent for yourself. When you become an independent person, you don't have any parent now who's looking out for your interests and doing all they can to advance it. That's your responsibility. And the person who's selfish is the person who assumes that responsibility for their own lives and puts themselves on a path and dedicates themselves to a path to achieving their happiness, which is what their parents, if they were good parents, did for them. And far from there something being wrong or evil about that, that's the essence of life, on her view. And that's what a proper notion of selfishness is. And when you have that notion, you have a radically different view of a radically different evaluation of whether selfishness is good or evil.